Okay, I'm going to call the remote hearing of Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order. And today, members, we're going to hear more information and detail about Waiver Reimagined. We've had a small introduction to it earlier this session. In 2017, the legislature directed DHS to try to streamline the program, make it easier to use, and have more consistency across our counties, and also to give more flexibility for those with disabilities to live and work in their communities and provide home and community-based services to those individuals and give them more control over the budget. So we're going to learn and get updated from DHS on the Waiver Reimagined program. And then we're going to hear one House file bill today from Representative Akam. So first, we're going to take the roll. Ms. Hansen?
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Chair Schultz?
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner?
Present.
Lead Albright?
Present.
Representative Bolden?
Present.
Representative Burkle?
Present.
Thank you. Representative Fisher? Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen? Representative Keel?
Present.
Representative Liebling?
Present.
Representative Mahler?
Present.
Good morning. Representative Noor?
Present.
Representative Novotny?
I am present.
Thank you. Representative Pearson?
Pearson present.
Representative Pinto?
Present.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen present.
Representative Robbins?
Present.
Representative Sandel? And Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher present.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. We do have a quorum. Let's see, Representative Liebling, would you like to move the minutes from February 17th?
So moved.
Okay, members, Representative Liebling moves the minutes from February 17th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please unmute yourself and say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails. The minutes from February 17th, 2021 are approved. So today we'll start with the presentation of the Waiver Reimagined program from DHS. We have, I believe, two individuals from DHS, Natasha Merz and Elise Bailey. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Madam Chair, my name is, and members of the committee, my name is Natasha Merz, and I'm the Director of the Disability Services Division within the Department of Human Services, and I will kick it over to my colleague Elise to introduce herself.
Hello, Chair Schultz members. My name is Elise Bailey. I'm the Fiscal Policy Director for DHS.
Well, welcome to the committee. Please begin your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. So we're here today to talk about Waiver Reimagined again and are grateful for the opportunity to share some additional information and more details about the individualized budgeting process. So just some high-level overview of our waiver system. The disability waiver system supports about 57,000 Minnesotans with disabilities to live, work, and engage in their communities with support from the home and community-based waiver. So, and we administer these programs in partnership with our lead agencies, county and tribal partners. And in fiscal year 2020, just over $3 billion was expended for disability waivers, with about half of that being state funding and the other half being federal funding. Spending for these programs is expected to exceed $4 billion. So wanted to talk through where we are in the Waiver Reimagined project, as it has several phases. And where we are today is seeking legislative authority to implement a budget methodology, for an individualized budget methodology for people that is known and transparent to people that use services and based on their needs as outlined in the assessment process. So we're going to talk in more detail about that. So before we get into details, though, I do want to emphasize and make sure the committee understands what is currently happening. We are a, as you all know, a lead agency administered system of human services, which means that our 87 county partners each have their own sort of policies, rules, and procedures for establishing how much money is spent on an individual person in their county on disability waiver spending. So basically, counties get a big pot of money, and then they're expected to manage waiver spending for the people for whom they're financially responsible within that aggregate budget. And what that means is that which county you live in can often determine what your budget is or how much money the county is able to spend by authorizing or not authorizing certain services. For the people that self-direct or act as their own employer under our community, under our CDCS program, that budget, that annual budget that people do get, has its own particular, has its own methodology. And what we're trying to do with Waiver Reimagine and individualized budgets is expand and make that methodology different than currently in CDCS, and that it will then also be more transparent and known to all people, regardless of whether they choose to self-direct or not. So individual budgeting methodology is a statewide method that would, again, do those things. So we know that this is a really significant and we think a very positive change for people in Minnesota in terms of access to resources and understanding how to work within existing resources for their services. So we have been doing a lot of statistical research and analysis to arrive at the budget methodology that we're going to talk through today. And so we've looked at claims data, and we've also looked at assessment data. MinChoices is our assessment tool. To develop the support ranges based on how people currently spend and use services. And as a part of that, we've looked at over 100 million data points to determine support ranges, had multi-year studies of service usage, service rates, and rate calculations. We've also done qualitative research with expert panels and reviewed additional data points and assessments to check or confirm the quantitative analysis that we did. So sort of doing that check to see is the qualitative lining up with the quantitative for the budget methodology that we're presenting. Next slide, please. All right, so Chair Schultz, with your permission, I'm gonna hand it over to Ms. Bailey to talk through the actual budgeting methodology.
Thank you, Ms. Mers. Ms. Bailey?
Thank you, Chair Schultz. I'd just like to start by saying we're really excited today to go over in detail this project. We've come to your committee a few times in the past over the several years that we've been having this project, and this is our opportunity to really get into the weeds. And so with that, I'll kind of go over how we determine the budgets and what it really means, what the governor's proposal on implementing these budgets may mean to people across the state. Director Mers and I will kind of go over some questions, some frequently asked questions that we've received since the governor's proposal has come out. So there's three main steps that we took in developing the budgets. First, we kind of looked at for an entire population, are there natural groupings of need across our state? So in this step, we wanted to identify what are the best number of ranges or budgets that we would want to set across our population. We have a wide variety of people receiving services on our waivers and a wide variety of needs. And our goal with developing these budgets is to create the best fit for people across the state. So in this step, we analyzed all of our assessment data, our service data, and our claims data, and statistically found where there's natural groupings of need. From that, we then moved on to step two, which was how do we create a methodology to where certain questions in our assessment could then point to the support ranges that we determined in level one. And so with this step, we looked at all of the questions, and our goal was to use as many data points as possible in our assessment to point to the exact budget category that a person would be assigned. Once we developed, okay, all of the questions on our assessment that do statistically drive or a level of need, then we kind of wanted to check, as Director Merz stated in her opening remarks, on the qualitative aspect of looking at all the information we have on people and their needs, and looking at a file review and making sure that the criteria that we had developed in step two really did point to the level of need that the person has and the services that they would require under the waivers. So all of that occurred without even looking at funding or dollar figures. And so that's where we moved to step three. So once we've kind of set the criteria for how a level of need would be determined, then we moved on to, okay, given this level of need, given these support ranges, what are the services that people need in their service plan? And so that's where we looked at the amount of services and the rates. And can you move on to the next slide? This is the point where we'll go through that. So going back to the second step, looking at the assessment, we wanted to gather as many questions as we could that would point to the level of need. And so we have a combined score across each of the following assessment areas that would determine the support need. So there's three general areas that that are in the calculation. So general support needs are needs that a person has with their activities of daily living, or instrumental activities of daily living. So those are their general support needs. Then there's a category in the criteria of health support needs. So these have to do with somebody's physical health, such as needing help with a trach or tube feeding, or managing allergies. Those are some examples. And then there's a third area of need, which is behavioral support. And those are needs having to do with somebody's behavioral needs, such as needing an intervention around a certain anxiety trigger or property destruction. So those are the three areas of the assessment that together would point to the support range that they would be assigned. The point of doing this and using as many questions as we can in the assessment is to make sure that no single question or even a handful of questions would determine a support range. This would enable families and people with disabilities to understand what their support range would be from year to year, and no given question on an assessment could dramatically change the amount of funding that they would have available to them. Next slide. So these are the support ranges for adults. Like I said, there's a general support need. So a person that doesn't have an exceptional need in health, in the health area or behavioral area, they would be assigned a range from 1 to 4, given the level of need that they have in the instrumental activities of daily living or the activities of daily living. If a person needs exceptional support in behavioral support needs or in health support needs, then they would either be in L, H, or E. So the L range would be if they have low or moderate general support needs, so instrumental daily living or activities of daily living, but they also have behavioral support needs, they would have assigned that level. If they have high general support needs or extensive general support needs and also have high health needs, they would be assigned a level H. And then if somebody has extraordinary health or behavioral support needs, regardless of their general support needs, they would be in the E category. Now, we know that the needs of children and adults are quite different. And so we, in the last few years, we've been really looking into what are the support ranges for children look like. And so given the needs of a child throughout their years change, and the services under the waivers consequently change, we have separate support ranges for children in ages 0 to 5, in 6 to 13, and 14 to 17. And on the screen here is just an example of the support ranges for children in 0 to 5 who qualify for the disability waivers. Next slide. So after we set, you know, the criteria for assigning the support needs with the assessment,
then, like I said, we move to how do we set a dollar figure for those budgets? And part of that question is really thinking about what services that a person would purchase under their budget. In that conversation, we had to think about, do all of the services under the waivers really make sense to include within this budget? And there are several that didn't make sense to include in the budget. And what this means is a person will be assigned a transparent and clear budget, but certain services they wouldn't have to account for within that budget. And the slide here is just an example of some of the services that wouldn't be counted against the budget. Some are market rates, such as crisis respite or assistive technology. Some are case management services through the lead agencies. Some are temporary one-time services that wouldn't make sense to include in the budget, such as modifications that you would need to make to your vehicle or home, or transitional services. And then a big key point for consumers of directed, self-directed services, they wouldn't have to account for their personal care, state plan personal care, or state plan nursing within their budget. Next slide. So once we determine what services are in and what services are out, and the majority of services are in, then we determine, well, what should really be the dollar value for each support range? And so in this step, we really looked at what are the services within that level of need that a person would purchase, what are those rates, and most of them are determined by the disability waiver rate system, so we looked at what the inputs and the final rates are for those, and then what are the volume of services that a person would typically purchase with this level of need. And for every service within that, then we add them all together to get to a total budget. So the services that we use, we call them service mixes, to determine what that budget is. They aren't necessarily the services we think every person on this support range would want to purchase. It's just a mechanism to determine what is the typical budget that a person would require with this level of need. And then the person could use the budget for whatever services they want to purchase that best fits in their life. So this slide is an example of budget range 3. So that's a person with general support needs who have relatively high general support needs and who live independently. So we created different service mixes for each, for different living settings, because the services that a person receives in a different living setting really depends. So this example is a person who's living independently. And this is how we came to the total budget. So as you can see, we added it all up. This example is about $67,000 a year. And we wanted to create a range so that, you know, there's the expectation that somebody would have fall within a minimum and maximum of a range. So in all the cases, we took it by half to get the low range and multiplied it by 105% to get the high range. So this slide, taking that example in the last slide of a person who lived independently and who's in the third level, they would be, I think, fourth, they would be at the $70,758 per year. And this is just a picture of all the total budget ranges for people who, for adults living independently. So what does a person do once they have assigned a budget? Where does it fit within the process of waiver services? And so this slide just kind of gives you a picture of what it will really look like in a person's planning. So first they would have an assessment. This is before the budget is created. And then they would, the assessment would lead to what the budget would be. The person would choose where they want to live. And so, as I said, we have those different service mixes and different budgets depending on where a person's lived, because the services that are available or accessible to them based on where they live depend on that. And so they would choose where they want to live, and then they would have a budget range based on that. And then they would have knowledge and information about how much money they have to plan for their services, and then they can work with their lead agency to build a plan that works for them within that budget. So one really, really good aspect of this program is that currently people have to go through their lead agency or case manager to get copies of their assessment, get copies of their service plan, and they don't have information about how much money is really available to them to plan for services. As I said, with the creation of this, it will make a clear and transparent understanding of how much money a person has to plan for their services, but they'll also be able to access that information. And this is really, really key to really enabling people to plan for what works best for them in their life. So just as most people, you and me, are able to access our banking information and our health insurance benefits and claims, Waiver Reimagine is planning to have an online tool where people with disabilities on the waiver programs can access similar information about themselves and their families. So information we plan on having available are: what did their assessment say? What does their current assessment say? What does the past assessment say? What are their current and past service plans say? How much money was spent in them? What services were authorized? Current and past spending. So there's always a difference between, you know, maybe what was authorized at the beginning of the year and what was actually spent. And then obviously the budget that they have to plan for services with. So this project is clearly a benefit to people to enable them to have access to information and to really have an equitable budget and service planning process, no matter where they live in the state and no matter who is helping them plan their services at the lead agency level. This is also a huge benefit on a systems perspective as well, in that lead agencies can focus on supporting people in their service planning without having to financially balance all of the needs of people within their county, that we can take that on at the state level instead of having the lead agencies worry about that aspect of managing the program. The individual budgets also can really provide a database conversation to policymakers and advocates across the state about future needed policy changes in the waiver programs. So, you know, we're not planning to set these budgets and just leave it. We're planning to use this information to really drive the conversation about what are the needs across the state that the waiver programs are serving, and how are those needs changing, and are there ways that the legislature or policymakers, are there changes that need to be made in order to fit the needs of people across the state in the future? After setting these budgets, we did a lot of analysis on what would the impact be to people. We want to make sure that rolling this out, that most people will have a positive experience and that we don't have any negative implications for implementing this individual budgeting model. So we've done extensive analysis on what are people currently spending, and if they choose to purchase the same level of services in the future, what would their spending be in the future? We found that 98% of people who currently self-direct and who live independently, with this model, they will have budgets equal to or higher than what they currently have. We also found that 89% of people living independently or with family will have budgets higher or equal to their current spending. And overall, over the whole program, 84% of all adults will have budgets higher or equal to their current spending. So overall, this project will give people information and empower them with information to plan, and it will be an equitable model across the state. And it also will result in, you know, having more funding at the fingertips of people across the state. Moving on to the frequently asked questions, I'm gonna go over the first few ones that involve the analysis and the fiscal impact, and I'll ask Director Merz to come back for the final ones. So we've gotten a lot of questions about, well, why are budgets higher for people choosing to live in a residential setting
than people choosing to live at home. And that is true because we use the services that are available when we determine what the budgets will be. And the budgets for people who choose to live in a residential setting are higher due to those services cost more money. So residential services, like most of the other services in this in the waivers, have legislatively set rates. And this project isn't attempting to change those rates. It's just using what we currently spend on those services and aligning a person's budget with that. So while they're higher technically for a person that lives in a residential setting, the buying power for a purchase for a person who lives in their own home and their family homes is actually greater because they have access to a larger number of services and they can choose from a larger menu of services than a person who lives in a residential setting. Overall, when we did our analysis of what would be, overall, when we did our analysis on what would be the, at the end of the day, what would be the impact to people in their own homes versus people in a residential setting, we found that the average spending is a reduction of 6.9% for people living in a residential setting versus an increase of 10.5% for people not living in a residential setting. Okay, now you can move. Another question we get, well, it sounds like a lot of people will benefit and have access to more money. Why is this proposal a savings? And excellent question. While it is true that this change will match or exceed the majority of people's current spending, we are projecting a slight reduction in the total statewide spending for the disability waivers. It's only about 0.5% in the first year and about 1.5% at full implementation. The reason this is the case is because we are looking at a small number of people who will have reductions in spending, and there will be budget caps in those aspects that don't exist today. So the spending we assume for people who don't have a rate, who don't have a budget exception, and who will have a lower budget than what they currently spend, that their spending will go down to the cap on their new budget. At the same time, a lot of people will have higher budgets. And in our analysis, even though somebody may have a lot more money in their budget, it doesn't mean that they will necessarily choose to spend to the cap of their budget. And so in our analysis, while we're assuming everyone who's going down, who's not having a rate exception will go down, we're not assuming the same for everyone who's going up. And so at the end of the day, the math works out to where it's a slight decrease in aggregate spending. Now, as I said, some people will have exceptions. We tried to create a model that had the best fit, that really adequately had criteria that assigned people to a level of need that really fits them. But we know that there are outliers and there are people that this model won't work for them. And so we are planning to have an exceptions process, much like we do for the disability waiver rate system, where we are able to look at somebody's exceptional needs and assign them a budget level that fits them. Next slide, okay. Another question we get is, well, how will people move between the two waiver systems? So we didn't talk much today about the other piece of this project, but we're moving from four waivers to two waivers, and the two waivers are based on where a person chooses to live. The governor's proposal doesn't include any limits to the movement between these waivers, and so this movement will be driven by the support planning process and where a person chooses to live. We are, however, developing a process to monitor the movement and to really understand the system impacts between the two waivers. How will individual budgets impact CDCS? So this is our self-directed program. And like Director Merz kind of said in her opening remarks, this project will really benefit people who choose to self-direct. So under the proposed changes, we're expanding self-direction. Currently, somebody has to choose to self-direct all of the services or none of their services. Under this project, everyone will have the same budget, whether you choose to self-direct or not, and you can choose to self-direct some of your services, all of your services, or none of your services. So it'll be a really flexible way to self-direct, and it will enable people to have more flexibility as they plan for the services that fit best in their lives. Another huge benefit to people who self-direct is that most people will have a larger budget than we currently do. Back when we implemented CDCS, we set the budget based on the information we had at the time, and we haven't been able to recalibrate that methodology. And so this is our opportunity to do that. And our analysis shows that most people will have a higher budget. From here, I think I'll turn it back to Director Mertz for the next question.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Director Mertz.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. So wanted to talk a little bit, where was the data gathered to develop the individual budget methodology? And we have talked about this periodically through this presentation, but we've used quantitative data from the Min Choices assessment. So back to 2017, we've also looked at claims in our claim system. So authorizations and services that are actually paid out to providers, rates, which are set primarily in statute by the Disability Waiver Rate Management System, and the inputs to those rate setting structures for over 4 years. So that's the quantitative data. And on the qualitative side, we had 3 years of stakeholder engagement, including 3 rounds of expert panels and 2 rounds of individual record reviews. So the expert panels were really about checking the assumptions about support ranges from the qualitative analysis and saying, gathering experts from lead agencies and saying to providers and saying, if we presented this, you know, this particular person, or you know, if we presented this assessment and this support range, would this make sense to you as someone who works in the field and authorizes services? And so that's the expert panel. And then 2 rounds of individual record reviews for where we felt like there was outliers and wanted to really seek and understand what's going on. Another common question we get is, can Min Choices support the individual budget implementation? And the answer is yes. The support ranges and their individual budgets are based on a majority of questions in Min Choices, and as Ms. Bailey said before, there's not one handful of questions that will fundamentally change the assessment outcome. It's a holistic look at the person's needs and wants based on that assessment process. So we did base our budget methodology from data in Min Choices between 2017 and 2019. And we also know that we will see periodic changes to the Min Choices assessment over time as we work on efficiencies and improvements, which we're currently doing right now, and that, you know, programs or rules may change within assessment and eligibility depending on policymakers' decisions, and we'll need a way to ongoing study and understand what changes to Min Choices and how that may or may not affect budgeting process. And so that is part of our long-term planning to support the policy goal of transparent, understandable, and data-based individualized budgets. Next slide. So how will this change impact me, or how will I know this change will impact me or my family member? So I wanted to bring us back to what I had mentioned before right now, which is there isn't a whole lot of transparency for people about how much money is being spent on their services and supports, and therefore hard for them to know and advocate for the plan that they really want to have. So again, you have to get a paper copies of the assessment via your case manager or assessor. And people generally, unless they have a CDCS budget, don't really have any idea how much money is being spent on their services and support. So in the future state, a person will be able to log into an online tool, and Ms. Bailey mentioned this earlier, access copies of past current assessments, see how that drives the budget support range to which they've been assigned, and they'll be able to see how much they've spent versus how much was authorized, and have that information and use that information for an ongoing planning process so that people can really use those services and supports to have the life they want rather than being focused on what program or what waiver that they is most advantageous for them to be on. We really want people focusing on their lives and not having to do deep dives into understanding the minutia of difference between different programs and services. So another question is, you know, that we get frequently is how have stakeholders been engaged in the development of the proposed budget methodology? And so we've had a variety of stakeholder engagement sessions. Certainly, we did take a pause on that during the initial stages of the pandemic for obvious reasons. But we did a quick survey and found that at some point lead agencies and people were ready to start engaging and thinking about this again. And so we pivoted and created online events so that we could seek feedback. So virtual stakeholder events, prioritizing attendance for people receiving services and their family. We've had training for lead agencies and providers on the new service menu that was launched in January, and had expert panels. This certainly is not the full scope of our stakeholder engagement. We've obviously done a lot of other things, but and we can provide that information to the committee if that's useful, but just wanted to really articulate that we have taken stakeholder engagement really seriously and tried to work and pivot really quickly under new circumstances, under the circumstances in which we're all living, to make stakeholder engagement a priority in this project. And also wanted to just wrap up by saying we have a short video that you're invited to watch if you'd like. There are flyers, frequently asked questions, and an email box if for people that want to specifically talk to the waiver policy team and the fiscal policy team that have been working so hard and diligently on this really exciting initiative. So that is the conclusion of our formal presentation.
Thank you, Director Merz and Ms. Bailey. I just want to thank them and their entire team at DHS. I know this was a huge undertaking, and I appreciate we had a more in-depth conversation getting ready for this hearing, and to hear all the work that went into the assessment and the validity and reliability and making sure families, if they answered one question, it did not drastically change their budget like historically it has been. So thank you for putting in all of this work and effort and for explaining it to our members and the public today. We really appreciate that. We're going to take members' questions. So I see Representative Robbins. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Director Merz and your team. I really applaud your hard work. I am excited that there will be more opportunity for people to self-select or self-direct and have more flexibility in their how they're planning. So I think it's fantastic. I'm optimistic it's going to work. But I know changing a system is very difficult. So we're partners with you in continuing to work through the details on this. But my question is about this new portal, where I understand why people will benefit from having access to their assessments and being able to look at all that information and better understand for making good choices and self-direction. But I have a family member who's on the waiver, and so I've seen this close up in my family's experience. And I wonder, how is this data, especially the assessment part, going to be safeguarded? And, you know, who will have access to it? My family member would not be able to access this portal personally. So who else on his care team would have access to this, and what are the limits of sharing this data and using it? If you could just address that, thank you.
Director Merz.
Chair Schultz, members, thank you for that question. So certainly people with disabilities that use Medicaid, like all of us, are entitled to confidentiality and privacy in their medical and health records that, you know, meet the highest levels of safety and confidentiality. So the portal that we're developing will meet all of those standards. It must, or we can't, you know, move forward with it. In terms of sharing data, I think our current thinking is that the individual person will be able to determine who has authorization to go in and do their record. So person will be able to give that to their support team, to their family members if they want, or not have people access that. I should say certainly, though, that the lead agency and the support planner, you know, representatives will have access to it because they need that information to actually authorize services and then input those services into MMI, into the billing software, basically. So, and it's just like it is today, where lead agencies have access to that information because it's a primary function of their position and the work that they do. But beyond that, people will be able to decide that. And, you know, we're still kind of figuring out the technological mechanisms to be able to do that. But I do want to, you know, reassure this committee that our commitment and the commitment of DHS overall is to make sure all that information is highly protected while it's still accessible to people that have the right to see it.
Thank you, Director. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Director Mers. I encourage you to continue to think hard about that. And I hope that whenever that part of the policy is rolled out, that maybe the Judiciary Committee would be able to take a look at that as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Representative Robbins. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also want to thank the department for all their hard work on this. And this presentation was really helpful to me today. So thank you so much. I have three questions, and I think maybe I'll just ask them all right now and they can figure out maybe who wants to answer. My first question has to do with county inconsistency and what I've heard about different counties providing different levels of services. And I'm just curious to know if you think the centralized budgeting process will really help eliminate some of those inconsistencies or is more needed to address those. My second question has to do with whether or not someone can appeal from a determination. I understand currently they can do that and just want to make sure that that appeal process is still available if people disagree with the amount that's been set for them. And then my final question has to do with the stakeholder engagement. And so I really appreciate the work you have done with respect to stakeholder engagement going into this. And I was just curious about stakeholder engagement as you're rolling this out. And will you do things like consumer satisfaction type surveys or something like that, really with folks in the disability community to find out how it's working for them? Thanks, Madam Chair.
Director Mers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So I can speak to those and then I'll ask Elise to jump in if she has anything further that, or Ms. Bailey, if she has anything further she'd like to offer. So we do believe that this the implementation of individualized budgeting will really, really help, if not eliminate the problem of inconsistency of resources spent on a person depending on which county that they live in. Certainly counties that are smaller and might have a smaller budget, if they have someone in their county that has a higher level of need, they may have to make really difficult choices to stay within their aggregate budget. Whereas someone that comes from a larger county, that county just has more money and therefore more flexibility to work within those confines to authorize services. So that's the current system that we have today. But moving to a statewide budget methodology will take the county out of that particular calculation and allow the county to do what it really does best, which is understand the services and supports and resources in their local community and help people access those. Some of them may be paid for by Medicaid and some of them may be community resources that are available to all people that live there. So the budget methodology will be consistent based on how a person answers the assessment and not dependent on what the county is trying to manage and balance in order to come out with that sort of package of services being authorized and therefore the amount of spending. So that's so second question is about appeal rights. And yes, certainly people will have appeal rights to the mechanism that exists would not be to appeal the individualized budget itself, but would be to appeal the results of the assessment that drive the eligibility process. And that is the same as it happens today with CDCS budgets. So if someone decides they want to self-direct their services, they ask and get a CDCS budget, and they don't think that budget is accurate or reflective of their needs, their legal option is to appeal the assessment outcome, to say the assessment didn't fully capture my needs, therefore the budget you've assigned me isn't consistent with my needs. So it's not exactly a straight line to appeal a budget amount, but all the same appeal rights that people have today will remain in place. And the third question, I believe, related to ongoing stakeholder engagement and will the department be checking in with people and doing maybe satisfaction surveys or things like that about their services? And the answer is absolutely yes. I will mention that even outside of the Waiver Reimagined project, we do have a customer satisfaction tool built into the Min Choices process and application called the LTSS improvement tool, where case managers and others will visit with people at about halfway through their service year span and ask a set of ask a set of consistent questions that will indicate their satisfaction with services and supports. Does the plan meet their needs? Do they feel respected? Things like that. So certainly that will be ongoing. And if we are able to implement individualized budgets, then we will likely also have some other way to check in with people and calibrate and see how things are working and not working. So the short answer is yes, some of that is in place today and some will be developed and more specific to Waiver Reimagine as we move forward.
Ms. Bailey, did you have anything else to add to that?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Schultz, and thanks for the question. I think that, you know, Director Merz really spoke well about the inconsistencies related to the funding. I would say from an analysis perspective, if you're looking at the entire system, you know, budgeting and the amount of money available to a person is one variable that's at play and inconsistencies across the state. And one benefit of this project is we can take that variable out of the equation and at a later date assess, are people still having differences in access to services across the state and, you know, develop solutions to those problems. And so one huge benefit of this is to really take that part out of the equation.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Representative Moeller, did you have any follow-up?
No, Madam Chair, that was really helpful. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Albright.
Good morning, Madam Chair. And I have three questions, and actually, I'm not sure if Director Merz or Ms. Bailey is most appropriate, but my first question goes to what Representative Moeller just kind of touched on in terms of the flexibility and long-winded, but I'm curious in terms of, obviously she touched on, if you're coming from a very highly populated county with a lot of county services, as opposed to one that is disparate in terms of their population, they're going to have cost disparities, but not only in terms of, as well as the providers nonetheless. So when we talk about the centralized versus the county-based, you know, decision-making process and that the counties will be relieved of that, aren't we also setting up, you know, a system that can have excesses in certain areas based upon, let's say, Hennepin County versus Lake County and the disparities between the benefits themselves? I'm wondering if you can expand on that analogy and just persuade me to believe that we've taken that into consideration. And Madam Chair, I have just a couple of minor follow-up questions for Director Merz as well.
Okay, thank you, Representative Albright. Director Merz?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for that question. I think I will ask Ms. Bailey to respond and then I can add anything that she doesn't cover.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and Representative. I think that's a really great question. Through the rate structure, we do have a factor that accounts for the differences in cost across the state. And in order to account for that in the budgeting process, we incorporated the highest, you know, factor, particularly in the metro areas where wages for direct support professionals are higher than across the state. So we did account for differences in provider costs across the state. With regards to your questions about potential excess, so in areas where maybe cost less, one great benefit to this project is that people still have the needs, like, regardless of where they are across the state. And this project enables people in event that they can't find a provider, that there's not enough providers available in their area, that this project supports greater self-direction to where they can get supports without the needs for traditional providers.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the director or Ms. Bailey. We talk a lot about technology in this committee and telehealth and, you know, just moving towards the use of technology for a lot of our medical services and the providership of them. We haven't had such a great track record in terms of rolling out new programs in the past, and we're moving forward on new ones here. I'm just wondering if you could speak to the coordination between the platforms that you intend to use, the involvement of Minit and or other services that would be contracted to help facilitate this. And are we then obligating, to use the word in that context, the counties to come along for that in terms of updating their own operating platforms to facilitate the usage of this new waiver reimagine?
Ms. Bailey or Director Mers?
Madam Chair, I can take that question. Thank you for that question, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So wanted to talk through the technology piece a little bit to Representative Albright's question. So first and foremost, the rate setting and budget methodology structures will be built, is not being built by Minit, but will be, is being built in conjunction with the third party vendor that we have for the MinChoices revision process. So the calculations and the methodology, or the calculations of the individualized budget that result from the support plan, will happen within that application. So counties won't have to update their software or their platforms unless they choose to, but they won't need to do it for Waiver Reimagined. Counties still will have to get the information out of the MinChoices application, and they'll have access to that third-party vendor. I should clarify that. They will have access and use it just as they're currently using the current MinChoices system. So there will be a transition to counties, but we aren't expecting them to have to incur any costs related to transitioning to the revised MinChoices platform. That platform will include all of the efficiencies and things that we've been working on with lead agencies on the application itself. That work is underway right now, as well as that validity and reliability testing. So when they transition over, that's part of that kind of normal process. And so we don't expect them to take any additional costs or expenses related to Waiver Reimagine. So I will pause there and see if that answered the question.
Thank you, Director Mers. Representative Albright, you have one more question, and then we need to move on because we have one more bill to present. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And that does go to the point. I'm sure that others like me on this committee who have a technology background certainly are keen to the rollout of any new technology, particularly when it involves those that might not have as much of an adept nature to them with regard to using technology. I'm sure that, you know, the various beta rollouts will be very rigorous, particularly in light of, you know, the county services that are beholden and being used by a lot of these folks. I really do appreciate the manner in which that this presentation was made this morning. I particularly appreciate the fact that you asked questions and answered them before we were raising them. And I think that goes a long ways towards building that level of trust that you've thought through the methodology that you're rolling this out with. I'm excited for it because I think, as you articulated in a couple of your slides, self-direction was keen. And I picked up on that a lot because, candidly, as we've spoken before numerous times, and I have in this committee, it really puts the individual at the center of their own care and their choices about that care. So I applaud your efforts, and I wish you the best in rolling it out, and let us know how progress is made. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright, for those comments, and we will be kept informed about how this rollout goes and continues. Representative Knorr.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I think starting from where Representative Albright left on the self-direction support activities, just wanted to know how will the waiver reimagine going to impact the financial management services or FMS, and also the support planning services that is included in the self-directed services. And also, if you can touch a little bit, do we have a plan to really expand those programs so that we can have more providers under that?
Director Mers or Ms. Bailey?
Director Mers.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Knorr, for that question. Those are really important questions, and I'm glad you raised them. So the expansion of self-directed options under Waiver Reimagine will create an additional demand and need for additional FMS providers. So the FMS providers are providers that help people that self-direct comply with legal requirements related to being the employer. So one thing to understand about self-direction is that when we say that in this context, we're talking about people that are electing to become the employer of their workers, of the people that are coming in and providing them with services. So in order for the person to be the employer, they have obligations related to, you know, taxes, workers' comp, all that kind of stuff, that all those compliance issues that employers have. And so the FMS providers are a service to help people accomplish that and help them manage within their budget and, you know, have a relationship between their support plan and the budget that they have to spend currently. So we do see an expanded need for FMS providers additional to the ones we have in place now for CDCS, because we expect and hope that more people will choose to self-direct in whether it's all of their budget or part of their budget, and therefore will need to have additional services, additional financial management services available, or ensure that there's sufficient capacity to meet needs and that the providers of those services are able to serve the communities that they serve, that they're especially our providers that are maybe smaller and serve culturally specific communities. It's really important to us that we have financial management providers that come from those communities and meet those needs. So we've been working on that. And in terms of support planners, I think the answer is definitely yes. We will see an ongoing need for what are currently CDCS support planners and maybe an expansion of those services and supports, as well as people being able to use their budget to pay for longer, maybe longer term plans, like a full person-centered plan that might, rather than be about the services that person is getting this year, it might be about what are my long-term goals as a person? Where do I want to be with employment? Do I want to move to my own place? And having person-centered planning that really drives that kind of life trajectory and life arc that will then turn around and inform the support planning in the immediate year.
Thank you, Director Merz. Representative Noor?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Director Merz. I'm glad that you brought the issue of expanding the outreach and also to be the stakeholders who from minority communities, BIPOC communities, to be included in the conversation, because this will impact everyone across the board. So thank you for the presentation.
Okay, I'm not seeing any more questions. Just thanks again to Director Merz and Ms. Bailey for the excellent presentation. And thank you, members, for asking really good questions. So we're going to move now to our next item on the agenda. We're going to be considering House File 976. So I'll move that Representative Akam's bill, House File 976, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. So we have the bill before us. Representative Akam, welcome to the committee. I see that you have an A1 amendment. Would you like us to move the A1 amendment so it's in the right shape before you go on to your presentation?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you.
Okay, I'll move that A1 amendment. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? I believe it's a technical amendment.
Yes, ma'am.
If not, please unmute yourself. All those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Akam, to your bill as amended.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 976 to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. House File 976 contains three policy provisions being brought forward by ARM, a trade association representing almost 200 home and community-based residential service providers. These initiatives look to support the important groundwork that the legislature set during the first special session of 2020, supporting individuals to choose where and how they want their services provided to them. The first provision provides for extension of remote services under the peacetime emergency. This is critical to ensure that the Department of Human Services has enough time to work with Centers for Medicare and Medicaid services in allowing for permanent access to remote support, ensuring that individual losses access to the critical services before final approval is received. The second provision directs the commissioner to work with stakeholders in the development of a service that would allow for direct support professionals and personal care assistants to be reimbursed when supporting individuals during short-term acute hospital visits. And the third provision creates a task force to examine the Minnesota Statute 245D and make recommendations to the legislature on potential changes to that statute, specific to the delivery of services for individuals that are living independently outside of a licensed provider-controlled setting. This report is due by June of 2022, providing the task force time to meet, as well as creating a timeline that gives recommendations, gives the recommendations time to come to the legislature for potential action during the next biennium. And with me this morning, I have Sarah Grafstrom from ARM to provide further detail about each of these provisions.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Sarah Grafstrom, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Sarah Grafstrom. I am the Director of State and Federal Policy with ARM. Thank you for the opportunity to speak and provide further detail on House File 976. As Representative Akam shared, we are excited to bring forward House File 976 and to offer some foundational steps we can take from the provider community in supporting the goals that have been laid out by the legislature and state in ensuring that individuals are being offered and supported in the choice they make and how and where they want services provided to them. The first provision in the bill, Section 1 and 2, extends the ability for individuals to access remote supports under the peacetime emergency until June of 2022. Access to remote supports has been a critical piece of providing services during the COVID pandemic. And through the necessity of providing services remotely, some individuals have found that it is actually a preferred way in working and engaging with their staff. One of our members recently shared this story with me. We support a gentleman that hates to have people coming in and out of his space. He also heavily relies on services to maintain his independence in his own apartment. He has a hard time with regularly scheduled visits and has a hard time keeping track of who is coming to see him and when. With us being able to do services remotely with him, we certainly have our normally scheduled days and times with him, but this has allowed us to be a lot more flexible with the days and times that we are able to connect in a meaningful way. He calls his staff frequently and they are able to do virtual meetings almost daily, whereas previously he would only be able to meet with staff face-to-face 2 to 3 times per week. And then they just shared, he and his staff worked to create a table during his time in quarantine, and he is now painting the table to really make it feel like it belongs in his space. Ensuring that individuals maintain access to remote supports while providers continue to engage with the Department of Human Services and developing a permanent option for some services will be critical in the continuation of services that individuals have grown accustomed to. The third section of the bill directs the Commissioner of DHS to work with stakeholders in the development of a service that would allow direct support professionals and personal care assistants to be reimbursed for time spent supporting individuals during short-term acute hospital visits. Although the development of this service may seem like a small policy change, it will make a big difference in the lives of people with disabilities who rely on these services. This initiative was passed in the Federal CARES Act 3.0, granting states the authority to develop this service in their state. The need for this service was highlighted well in a letter last January from the National Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities supporting the federal legislation. They shared, DSPs and the people they support build relationships and familiarity that can play a crucial role in avoiding unnecessary trauma during hospital stays. Hospital stays are often stressful under the best of circumstances, and that stress can be greatly compounded for people with disabilities. People with specific behavioral support needs, communication needs, or other challenges can become overwhelmed, disoriented, and distressed in hospitals. Without a familiar presence to reassure them, they may not be able to understand requests from medical staff. Waiver recipients with mealtime assistance plans or specific methods to transfer or reposition often do not receive care tailored to their needs by hospital staff because the hospital staff may be unfamiliar with those needs or not trained on how to meet them. Individuals may be unable to communicate with hospital staff, may suffer restraint, and may even be unable to eat throughout their stay. These kinds of traumatic experiences can cause additional behavioral challenges when an individual returns home, resulting in intensified service needs or even a change in placement. And finally, the last piece of the bill, Section 4, creates a task force to review Minnesota Statute 245D and make recommendations to the legislature by June of 2022 on potential changes to the statute specific to when services are provided outside of a provider-controlled license setting in a person's own home. Many of the regulations and questions that are within the statute are appropriate for individuals that are accessing services 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in a provider-controlled setting. But for those individuals who may need limited support throughout the week, they can become a deterrent from accessing services altogether. Specifically, reviewing the service planning and delivery assessment questions and timelines through the lens of the individual receiving services and accessing how the process is experienced by an individual who is receiving services may result in a more streamlined service and allow for greater engagement from the individuals that are accessing the services. We believe that developing a task force that includes individuals who are receiving services in their home, as well as the providers who are providing them, will allow for a dialogue on what makes the most sense from both a licensing and health and safety perspective, as well as an individual who is receiving and experiencing the services perspective. And with that, Madam Chair, that is our bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Ms. Grafstrom. Now, we don't have the fiscal note yet, and I don't know if Representative Akam has an idea of what this would cost, given something similar through the executive order from the agency. Representative Akam, do you have a ballpark figure at all about the cost of this? Otherwise, we'll wait for the fiscal note and bring that back.
I think, Madam Chair, that's the best idea. I don't have a ballpark.
Okay. Looks like Representative Albright, please proceed with your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if I pose this question either to Representative Akam or to Ms. Grafstrom, but you know, I think that we can all agree that the overall goals of this initiative are laudable. But that being said, my concern with this bill pertains to the delegation of our responsibilities to wrestle with these issues to a very large department agency with little or no broad input as the discussion proceeds. And I noted that the commission does not include anyone from the legislature, whether that be from the Senate or the House side. So Representative Akam, I'm wondering if you would be willing to respond to that observation.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. It's my understanding, and I'll defer to Sarah Grafstrom for certainty, but it's my understanding that the recommendations will be coming through DHS and a stakeholder group. And so I think that there will be quite a bit of input going into this final conclusion. It's an important piece that we need to get right, and so we do need to get input on it. I'll refer to Sarah Grafstrom.
Ms. Grafstrom.
Thank you, Chair Schultz, and excuse me, Representative Albright. I certainly think you bring up a really valid point. And Representative Akam is correct that any recommendations that come out of the task force will then need to go to the legislature for their involvement and feedback. But certainly, as we continue to move through the process this session, would be happy to speak with you about the possibility of the addition of legislative representatives to that task force as well.
Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Akam, I would urge you to, much like we have for the Work Comp Commission and others, the participation, at least in the hearings, rather than as a voting member, as a sounding board and witness to the proceedings that certainly could speak to working in a bipartisan manner on something that's so important. I would urge you to consider adding those provisions so that when we come to committee with the outcome of that commission, it isn't coming from a cold start, that there actually has been work conveyed and a verification of that peace in the valley, if you will, across the aisle on this matter, which is very important to a lot of people. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Akam. I wonder, I've been trying to listen to the conversation here, and the piece I really want to ask about is the same piece I think that Representative Albright was asking about this. And I'm looking at the language. It's the section for the I don't think it's called a commission, but the task force. And it's called the Unit-Based Services Advisory Task Force. And I'm just a little bit unclear if you could, maybe if Ms. Grafstrom could take this, what is unit-based? And just give me a little more understanding of what issue this task force is trying to figure out. I'm sorry if I missed it, but I'm just very foggy on this. I heard a lot about the piece about providing services in hospital, which I think is a very good idea, but I didn't hear as much about what this is supposed to figure out. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Ms. Grafstrom?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Schultz and Representative Liebling. So that's a really good question, and I think something that you're right, we probably should clarify. So unit-based services are services that are provided on 15-minute increments to people that live independently outside of provider-controlled license settings or your typical four-person group home, so in a person's own home. And what our provider, and oftentimes are accessed, maybe 2 to 3 times a week for a couple hours a week, a provider or their direct support professional will come into the person's own home, work with that individual on different goals and just different things that they need support with on a limited basis. What our providers are have shared with us that in the past, specifically around the initial service assessment questions, the assessment questions can oftentimes actually be a deterrent for an individual to actually want to access services. So for example, there's an assessment question that the provider who maybe just met someone, maybe the individual is hesitant to be accessing services at all, and now the stranger's coming in and asking them about their ability to regulate water temperature. And it can feel demeaning and it can feel demoralizing. And oftentimes providers have said the assessment gets ripped up and handed back to the person asking the question, and the person says, I don't want services at all. So what we would like to do is look at that along with other things within the licensing statute and say, what might be changed that better meets the needs of the individual, that supports the questions that need to be asked, but in a more person-centered way that can still get to the service planning and assessment piece, but maybe in a way that works better for the individual accessing those services.
Thank you, Ms. Grafstrom. Chair Liebling?
Thank you. That's helpful. So how does this interact with the presentation we just heard, Waiver Reimagine? I mean, are we going over some of the same ground here, or is this kind of, well, if Waiver Reimagine doesn't happen, then we need this, or do we need both? I'm a little unclear on that.
Ms. Grafstrom?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Schultz, Representative Liebling. We think this dovetails really well with the goals of the department for Waiver Reimagine, specifically. It wasn't presented on today, but the goal of moving from 4 waivers to 2 and moving away from a waiver specific to a person's diagnosis and towards waivers that are where the person lives. And so we think this work is really important, just to kind of go hand in hand with the work that is going on with Waiver Reimagine. And it's not my understanding that looking at 245D and the licensing statute is part of the work that's going on right now. And so we think it's going to be a really great addition to the work that's already happening.
Chair Liebling?
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for that. So I just do want to comment on something that Representative Albright raised too about needing to have someone from the legislature on this. I guess I'd like to push back on that a bit. This is not really for Ms. Grafstrom so much, but just members, to a discussion among members. We have so many task forces and commissions and bodies, and oftentimes we try to put legislators on them, and we have 2 from each body and 2 from each party. And I don't know about you, but I have a great deal of difficulty fitting all of that into my life. You know, at some point, if you know, we're a part-time legislature, and I appreciate that we would like to know and be involved in all things, but I think we have to be a little cautious, and sometimes we need to allow people to do their work and come back to us and explain it to us rather than, you know, appointing one among us or two among us or four among us to be involved in it. And I also would observe that oftentimes I'm appointed to these things and I show up and other members don't. And there are probably times when they would say that about me as well. So I just want to inject that as a sort of point of thought for members as we go forward on this and other kinds of task forces and commissions, et cetera. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I second that. And I also want, especially our new members, to know that I'm often invited to task forces or meetings if they want my opinion or they want to inform me about something or ask questions. So that is another opportunity legislators have. They don't have to officially sit on these task forces. And I'm sure many of them would welcome legislators if they wanted to observe or participate in some of these meetings. But with that, I'm not seeing any more questions. And Representative Akam, I don't have any more testifiers on the list. Do you want to give us some closing remarks?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, committee members, for the discussion today. I appreciate it. We'll continue to work with people as we continue to move forward. And I appreciate your support in this today.
Thank you. So again, House File number 976 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. With that, thank you, Representative Akam and Ms. Grafstrom, for coming to our committee and presenting your bill. Next week, members, we have a full slate of bills. We'll be meeting each day next week, and that will be posted shortly. So watch your emails and the committee website. And with that, members, we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.